Have you read Chris on your mind? No, I'm not okay with you.
When I wrote that,
you remember
what was it? It was conceptually, we have to work on the conceptual apparatus that we have, and this appears to be slow on the intellectual apparatus. In other words, we get involved in a situation that we can say, that there is something that we've been about. But it already precipitates now. The whole concept you can get a hold of. And I was wondering, what was the method of attacking this at the front?
Let's do a drawing of our three-part man again. We know that when a nervous impulse goes from the brain to produce a voluntary act, but it takes a measurable length of time to get the message down the spinal nerves and into, say, a leg. This amount of time, taking a portion of a second, is very, very slow compared with the reaction speed in certain life preservative instinctive responses. We know that we have a method of response far quicker than this process of voluntary, individuated transmission of a nervous impulse. You know that if you put your finger on a hot plate without being aware of it, you will be aware that you are burned and of an attempt to get away from it, but it's taken a certain length of time for the message to get from the finger to the brain center and from the brain center back to the finger, so there's a delay and the finger is burned. If you had an immediate response through the field, that would not occur. And that only occurs when you are abstracted in certain ways and therefore out of the situation. In the situation, with your feeling appreciation of it, you would function much quicker. Now, when we are talking about the evolution of man, we're talking about the various stages at which his will functions, levels of being. When a baby is born, most of its reflexes are from the mouth and down the food tube and from the nostrils to the lungs. We will say that the one from the mouth to the food tube is the first one, because we find that the baby will spend quite a lot of time with its eyes closed and not taking much notice of things sent to it, and its sensations around the mouth are to it of primary importance. Later on, when through repeated stimuli through the ears, certain forms are put into the mind, they are verbalized forms, and the verbalized forms put through the ear have a certain length of nerve tract to go around, which takes time, and the immediacy of response has disappeared. Now, as it grows older, a greater number of words is put in, and the act of deciding becomes progressively more and more complicated, so that when you come to think through seriously a situation needing a decision, if you take all the elements of the decision and individually, consciously serialize them and then try to evaluate them, you will take up a considerable amount of time and fail to solve it. You notice in the Devil Book that it is said there, count all or count not at all, because when you start the serializing process of counting all the elements in the situation, if you don't count them all, the ones you have left out will undo you and invalidate your solution. If you do count them all serially, you're going to take an awful long time. So unless there is another mode of response, as the speed of the stimuli coming to you is greater than the speed of your thought process for evaluating them, your reaction time will always be behind the fact. And this is a matter of experience of people in daily living. They find they have done things and said things which, if they had been able to inhibit them, they would not have done or said. And in this saying, they are committed into relations that they don't want. That is because an immediate stimulus comes in and runs down into the appetite centres, which are more immediate than the intellective ones. So that if somebody shouts at you suddenly, violently, you will tend to jump and get out of the way before thinking about it. As soon as you begin to think about the thing, you interfere with it, slow down your reaction time, and the new stimulus is upon you before you've had time to evaluate the old one. A very simple illustration is that if you try to go downstairs consciously, individually, serializing the movements of the muscles in your legs as you put your feet on the stairs, you will find that if you try to run down doing that, you will fall down. That is because once the body is on the move, gravity is carrying you down, you're moving very, very quickly, and you literally haven't got time to get the data filed in here and run through all the necessary data for the given muscular act of going downstairs and then send it down to the legs in the appropriate order. You're already down. The same thing done a little more safely is to run upstairs and get them down, because then you don't fall very hard. But you'll find the same thing if you try to run upstairs with individual serial thought, that you will simply interfere with your process and it won't function properly. Now, the problem is this: as the organism can respond immediately from field awareness, the total organic reaction of field awareness, and the stimulus comes frequently through the field, if a man has inertia tendencies to think serially through the process, then his analysis of the situation will never be in step with the actual situation, which means he's always living behind himself, and he's always finding himself committed into a situation which no longer exists. How to get out of this process? If the serialization takes time is actually a rotation of forces. If it takes time to go around the cycle, which has been defined by the initial term you start with, and all its implications, which have to be explicated. Remember, as soon as you have a governing concept, you have a word, and that word contains implications, and to serialize, the meaning of the word is to explicate those implications, and it occurs in time. And if you do this serially, you will never act correctly. You'll always be anachronistic, just behind the time of the situation. So first of all, you have to learn how to dissociate from this serializing process. For this, you have the governing concept that the observer is not the observed. You can't state it too often to yourself. Let the paper represent the pure consciousness of spirit. Spirit is power and sentiency. It is a power that is able, by rotating, to embody itself, and it feels the mode of its own action. So its action, its embodiment, and its awareness are not three separate substances. They are three aspects of one fact of sentient power. To understand the Trinity of Christianity, or the three body doctrine of the Buddhists, requires us to remember this simple fact, which we illustrate by saying that the paper is the power sentiency itself, the sentient power. It knows nothing other than itself, because no being, and no non-being either, can ever understand or experience anything other than the modifications of itself. So if this paper, this sentient power, does nothing, it experiences nothing. But if it waves, it experiences waving. Now, if we imagine we roll the paper up like it is at the top here, we make ourselves, here's a perspective of it, to make ourselves a roll of paper, we have involved, by rolling the paper round, certain experiences which the power sentient, the sentient power, knows of itself, that it has rolled itself up, involved itself. Whatever drawings there are on the inside of that roll can be experienced in a peculiar relationship in the rolled up state. If we write on the outside A and then go around one turn and write below it B, and go around another turn and write below that C, then if we look straight through there, we identify with successive layers, we will see A, B, C in the same time space. And if we pull the roll out and extend it, we will see A, B, and C serially. Now this involved state, the in-willed state, is what it meant by the word same. And this same, Zama, same spelling, modern day Zama, seed state, implies spiritual energy substantializing itself in a field. This is a field substance energy of spirit, which is sentient power. It has turned itself round and put into seed that which it is in its infinite extension. There is nothing involved that cannot be evolved, turned out. Complication means with folds. If we imagine we fold the paper backwards and forwards like this, then we have exactly the same problem. We have a simple piece of paper. When we pull it out, simple, same ply, seed folded. And if we extend the thing serially, the letters which would have been vertically above each other on the folded paper will appear after each other in time. So we can experience simultaneously different levels of being, and by levels of being we mean these folds of being, by simply learning to focus through the field instead of being dictated to by continuous external stimulus. Here are two beings. The perimeters of those two beings are in contact. As they impinge on each other, they disturb each other's substance. There's an empty hole in the middle that can't be disturbed, even in spirit. Now, the stimulating energy coming from outside, if focused upon, must cause an externalization of consciousness. It forces the consciousness onto the perimeter of the being. Now the perimeter of the being is the part of it that has no understanding whatever. Observe that at this point of contact, these two beings are in the least possible contact. And therefore, in the physical relation shown by these two circles touching each other, there is the least possible kind of relation for any two beings. If you want to increase relationship, therefore, you must discover something totally different. From the center of the being, emanating, is the power of sentient. And as it's coming out, it's spreading out centripetally, spherically, centripetally from the point of view of a being observing it flying out from the center. It is coming out, and in so doing, because of the overlapping of the continued stimulus from outside, you have a progressive veiling of the inner creative sentient power. The nearer you get to the perimeter, the more disturbance there is from the contingent stimulus. If you go into your center there, the contingent stimulus cannot touch you at all. You're in the immanent spirit. If you get just outside that bound, the contingent stimulus reaches you. But it is less intense on the inside than on the outside. Now let's make a slightly larger diagram for a moment. This is a being, an immanent spirit, and transcendent spirit outside it. Here's a continued stimulus from another being. Now, that being outside constitutes a promise and a threat simultaneously. A promise of a relationship that might be valuable, and the threat of a stimulus that might impose on you and stop you developing your own immanent spirit. So we have a stimulus continued coming in and an immanent creative spirit pressing out. Between the two here, we can draw a band and say that on this band the two are equal. Below this band, the immanent spirit is victorious over the incoming stimulus, and above that band, the continued stimulus is triumphant. Now in this outer band here, we can place the five senses. Where the five senses reach, there is dominion for the continued stimulus. And inside here, there is dominion for the immanent spirit. But at a certain level, we'll call it halfway between, without defining what halfway means. Really, we mean it dynamically, not in terms of so many inches. Where the power from inside balances the power from outside, there is a zone where the contingent stimuli of the five senses can be observed and brought into relation with the immanent spirit's creative movement. This is a zone where an artist stands when he's controlling his pencil or paintbrush. He has his creative spirit coming out and he keeps his eye on his paintbrush so that he can see what it's doing. If he's copying somebody else's paintbrush work, then the external stimulus is determining what he does. But if he is looking on the underside of this band, he sees what creative spirit is trying to do, and he allows his hand to obey the immanent spirit instead of the external stimulus. This is the difference between artistic creation and copying. Now, we know that we have relations with other beings, and we'll call these, if you like, social relations. And as all beings in a contingent stimulus situation are surrounded by other beings, which promise and threaten simultaneously, it follows that some of the activity of this inside spirit might be unacceptable to socialized beings on the outside. This stuff that's coming up that is not acceptable to society, the social being, which is the external being, will send forces to stop it coming up. So we have a special zone down here where the social pressures meet the creative spirit and try to stop it spreading out. So that everything that is creative in an individual and which appears to be antisocial will be repressed by the conceptualized social energies, which are the energies of social concepts. They will spin round and stop this creativity working. Now all these are different speeds. The one that serializes is the level of the five sense stimuli. And as you go progressively inward, you're becoming less and less serial, more and more simultaneous in your awareness. It is possible to go inside and to cut off progressive layers from the outside, so that in the process of going in you become progressively less and less aware of the external world. This is a method of quietism, but it is not the best method because it actually leaves you immobilized, perhaps in a room or in a desert or a forest, and then the ants might come and build a nest around you. Ideally, you should be absolutely aware, not just internally aware. The quietest mystic, who forgets about his body, forgets he has one, and contemplates the creativity of immanent spirit as it bubbles up, is not doing all he might do, because he might be watching his physical body as well. And the absolute is aware of all these things. So in absolute identification, he has actually got identification with the gross material body as well as with the creative spirit on the inside. When we're talking in psychological terms, orthodox psychology, what they call the subconscious is not as deep as the one we've just illustrated. The Freudian subconscious doesn't deal with the creativity of the immanent spirit spreading out and being stuck by the social consciousness. He deals only with biological forces, which cannot go any deeper than this particular band, where the social forces impinge on individual forces, which are themselves in their totality social. So that in that psychological analysis, there is no difference between the social conscience and the collective individual consciences. We have a group of individuals, each one of which is essentially pleasure-seeking in that analysis. There is no deeper principle, no creativity, but simply this pursuit of pleasure through beings who are supposed to be, in this theory, pleasure-driven. So there is no social law other than the law that pleasure-seeking beings will stop other pleasure-seeking beings from getting their pleasures if they interfere with the pleasures of the others. And this is essentially a very, very simple analysis and allows for no creativity at all. Thus, in the Freudian analysis, an architect building the Empire State Building is simply a man sexually thwarted who's trying to make the biggest phallic demonstration he can. Now, obviously, such an analysis is materialistic and quite external, and the whole of the Freudian position is based on analysis of five sense data. Now, Carl Jung allows that there is another zone deeper than the individual, which he calls the collective unconscious. But this, for him, is still only the collective unconscious of the ancestors of the individuals. So in a very peculiar sense, it's still a biological proposition and an empirical proposition, because he's dealing with individual human beings and their individual human ancestors. He's seeing that the protoplasm of these beings is the same protoplasm, and that somehow the experience of this protoplasm can be contacted and handed down and may spring up in the form of dreams or fantasy drawings. But he is not seeing inside this biological fact another fact, the fact of the essential creativity of this absolute. So really, in his fairly recent work on God, he has produced a book that treats of the concept of God in a way unacceptable to many theologians, because really it's a biological concept he's got and not a spiritual one. Now, we're talking about how to break down the serialization which acts slower than our immediate awareness. If we don't break down this serial thought in the mind, because the serial process occupies more time than the immediate necessities of the moment, the serial process must always be behind the reaction time. Like a man who's always getting a black eye because he's a bit slow in putting his arm on. He can see it coming, but it takes time to get the message down the arm. Or a man driving a car with no road signs. He drives along and he sees a car, he sees a woman leave the pavement, and he doesn't add up car, woman crossing pavement, change of behaviour in the car in front. And by the time it's at the back of the car stops and he's hit the number plate. His reaction time is slow. And this reaction time gets slower and slower the more energy is involved in the five sense process inside. So we find that men, as they're getting older and older and more reminiscent, are getting slower and slower in their reaction times in physically dangerous situations. So we see the obscuring effect of the five sense serializing activities. Now, how to break it? First, we have to say the observer is not the observed. That is to say that the paper is not the waving of the paper. And this is a very important thing, particularly in Zen Buddhism, where the awareness of the abrupt school, the southern school of Zen, which is identical with the European mystics who understood the same thing, says that although the paper is not the motion of the paper, there is no motion of the paper other than the paper moving. If you identify with the paper, you can keep still. If you identify with the motion, you can't keep still. You can keep moving. If you are identified with the motion, you have no power to do anything at all. No choice. You are simply identified and you are moving. If you are identified with the paper, and remember to define it, the paper equals sentient power, which is initiative, feeling itself. It can increase or decrease the amount of movement it has. So in that sense, there is no difference absolutely between the paper and the movement of the paper, because the movement of the paper is the paper moving. So when one monk asked a Zen master, "What is the Tao?" he says, "Eating when one is hungry is Tao. Drinking when one is thirsty." The monk should reply, "But everybody is already doing this." To which the master would reply, "They are not doing like I'm doing, because they don't know they're doing it, and I do." You see, they are reacting to an external stimulus. But on the inside, there is an immanent spirit which tells you before the external stimulus hits you that you are hungry. You probably be first at the table, to the glass. The person who is externally determined by the five sense stimuli, he has to wait for the stimulus to come. So he doesn't know he's hungry till he sees a poster of a meal steaming. But he is. But he's so preoccupied with some other external stimulus that he's unaware that his body is hungry. So he is acting when the external stimulus makes him act. Whereas the person who is identified with his paper, his essential self-nature, and is aware of all the motions which he is making them. He's not waiting for an external to make them for him. He is making them. He is aware that the energy level, the amount of motion in his self-nature, is dropping below that which he requires for his next function. And his next function does not mean temporally, serially, but it means the next one ontologically presented immediately below the folded piece of paper which he sees through. There is A, and there is B, and there is C. He sees them simultaneously, as you can see through the three pieces of cellophane, the letters A, B, and C, one on each piece of paper. You look through and you see A, B, C at once. You separate them and you have to take 3 seconds to do it. He sees immediately, he has a job to do. C, he had energy A, he now has energy B. He needs energy C. He sees that simultaneously. He doesn't need an external stimulus to tell him that his energy level is a little lower than needed for his next job. Next job ontologically, not temporarily. When he sees this, he immediately goes and starts eating, or whatever else he wants to do. He's doing it deliberately and from inside, and therefore with initiative. He is not waiting for the stimulus. The average man, in a relation with a woman, for instance, would find, in practice, that he never thinks about a girl until the ITV ad or a poster in the street tell him to think about it. He's preoccupied with something else, a bit of radio or a motorbike engine. Until the stimulus comes, he doesn't know about them. And he's so battered by stimuli from outside that he has no awareness that the immanent spirit inside him has been very busy making sperms, and that those are now ready, characterized for fertilizing somebody. He doesn't know that. And meanwhile, they're moving. That's like a cross section of a testicle. They're moving, only in this case they're moving inwards to shoot out. And at the point of maturity, they're going to get a way out somehow. The man, dependent on the external stimulus, does not know that they're about to come out, that it's their time to come out. And therefore, when the stimulus hits him, he gets a shock. The thing responds mechanically and he has no control over it. So he cannot choose the target. It might be that he finds he's taken out a very strange girl, that in a more balanced condition he wouldn't have taken. If he had been aware of the whole field of his being, known serially, he would have known exactly how they were developing and whether they were ready for out and whether they would prefer one target to another. And he would find that target from immanent spiritual activity. And he would not accept a substitute target inferior to the one envisaged by the immanent spirit. So in the very, very same act, there are two exactly opposite modes of response to it. One determined by an external stimulus, and one by the free creative activity. We have to break the serializing process, simply because it depends on the original five sense stimuli, which follow each other, and in their continuous following can never be added up, so that serially we can never have enough data to deal with anything adequately. So that a man who tries to understand his girl by cross-questioning her will never catch up with the large number of data he would need to compute, because according to her principle called TWT, or that was then, she had made some more data since she opened her mouth and gave him the last information. So unless he feels right through the whole field and gets hold of her state of being, he does not know what to do. This accounts for being so often repulsed. In this non-serial awareness, we have, we were talking about in the car coming up actually, two opposite ways. Here is one man, and here is another. There's a pointed man, and here is a six-pointed man. We have here the case of a man who's been battered so hard by a certain order of stimulus that the whole of his being, substantially, is vibrating with that stimulus. He knows only one thing, he's monoideistic, and he's a catatonic. He's completely fixed, he cannot move, he is a banana. He cannot evaluate a banana because he is a banana. To evaluate a thing, one must have a letter V. One must place banana over there, and the concepts of fruits of various kinds over here, with the governing concept fruit, and he must have an eye down there, and he must look along there and along there and make a connection. That is his mode of evaluation. But if the stimulus comes so strongly at him that it throws his substance continuously into the same form, continuous stimulation is equal to no stimulation, he knows only the banana, and therefore he knows nothing, not even the banana. He cannot evaluate it because he can't let go of it to look at the other thing that he has to evaluate it against. So his monoidism is non-serial because he's just a banana, and his being is going banana, like the Chinese mountain that is a mountain because it's just meditating mountain. Such a man, I know one who'd been, in 1946 he'd been 17 years still, stuck in the same condition. They hadn't managed to knock him out with every treatment they had. And he didn't understand what he was being it. And to be totally identified with anything whatever is to be incapable of evaluating the thing with which one is identified. So to evaluate, one must break identification. But there is one mode, the negative mode of non-serialized thought. That is to say, thought captured by a powerful stimulus, the being saturated with the stimulus, then there is no room for any other stimulus whatever, and therefore one is being that thing, and therefore has no energy left over to separate it, to evaluate it. That's a very low-level kind of existence. It's the condition of a man whose private hell consists in being locked up in what is in effect to him non-being, because it is simply being one undifferentiated form. And in the other case, we have a man who is fully aware of the polarity of being, of the paradoxical nature of yes and no, of idea and will. He knows that if he stops the external stimulus from dominating him and deliberately shifts his attention from that which he's serializing and gets hold of the feeling of his being, he will simultaneously feel every process in his body, simply because they're going on simultaneously. He's not feeling together things that are serial. He is simultaneously experiencing what is simultaneous. We can demonstrate this in various ways. One of the ways is to show a person that what he calls his past existence is still present in his body and still determined. In the same way, we can show that what a person will call his future is already in his substance. And if he doesn't had the appropriate stimuli to knock him off it, he will fulfill the destiny of his own substance. And if we insert a new stimulus in, we can alter his life in 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years by inserting a new determinant in now, which alters the configuration, which has a logical end in 20 years hence. In this kind of non-serial thought, we have a person who, instead of being completely focused on one form, is focused on no form whatever. He is paper identified. He's not identified with the motions, but with the paper. Now this paper is moving. But you can see that in practice, you don't have to watch the motion. You have the power to watch the paper without the motion. If I wave the paper, and you look at the paper as paper, you will find that the content of your mind is different from if I ask you to watch the edge of the paper waving. Watch the edge of the paper waving, and you become identified with the motion. Now take it off the edge, which is a definition, and put it onto the paper, and say this is just paper. The waving of the paper is irrelevant. It is just paper. Now, the movement of the paper is now peripheral. It's still there. You're aware that it is moving. You are not identifying with it. Therefore, you're free from it. So you see that, in fact, you can do two things. You can identify with the paper when it is moving without identifying with the motion. You can be aware that the motion exists without it determining your action. Simultaneously, being aware of the motion, you can be aware that the paper as such is unchanged, that nothing is lost. If you then say the paper is the power, the sentient power of the absolute, and the motions thereof that we observe as the created universe are simply motions of it, we can do exactly the same exercise. We can center ourselves on our power, sentience, our sentience power. In ourselves, we can still wave our hand, and we can feel our field while we're waving our hand, which is quite different from waving the hand and concentrating it, which is a very good exercise. There are a lot of brave men in the audience, they can do it now. Let's wave our hands like this, and put the eye on the hand and see what happens to the sensations in the mind while you're trying to follow it. Do it slowly first so that you can follow it. Then increase the speed, and you'll find the attempt to follow it does funny things with your mind. Now keep it waving, and instead of thinking about the movement, think about the feeling of the hand. Now the movement of it lapses from consciousness, but you have a definite substantial feeling that the hand is still there. And this is a fact that we have such power. We can feel the hand, and we are not confused by the motion. And we can focus on the motion and forget the hand and become confused. And this is an observed fact. Now it's exactly this that we do with this sentient power. We can get hold of sentient power, and it doesn't matter how madly the universe gyrates. Gyrates, that is it. And if we focus on the gyrations of it and try to keep up with them, we become very dizzy, very confused. But if we just remember that this is sentient power vibrating itself, when we get hold of the power, we can see what it is doing, but we are not confused. We have no doubt when we are waving the hand that the hand is waving, and we understand it very well by just feeling the hand's substance. We don't get any more information by trying to follow it. We get less, because we get confused. In the tag, let go and let God, is simply the direction. Let go of the conscious individual, or the individuated conscious attempt to keep up with the motions of the universe, and let God, that is to say, the absolute itself, which is this paper moving these things, do what it will. It will always do better than the confused individual will do with the same data. So as far as the technique of getting off the level of serial thought to the higher level is concerned, first we say the observer is not the observed. We describe what we mean by it. The paper is not the motion of the paper. but the motion is of the paper, that actually we can identify with the paper when it is moving, and we are not confused, or with the motion of the paper, and forget the paper, and then we become confused. So we identify with the sentient power, we break identification with the motion, but the motion does not thereby cease. Now the attempt to make it cease is one of the greatest stupidities that pseudo-mystics have ever done. If we try to stop creation absolutely, to level all things, to produce this maximum entropy of being, we produce nothing. If we actually take the mind waves as they appear and hammer them down flat, we'd have to hammer from both sides to do it successfully. If we hammer them flat, when we have succeeded and we can do it, what we have got is precisely nothing except self-created stupor. And this self-created stupor has often been mistaken by people, and this is how the quietists came to be condemned, because misunderstood quietism means hammer your mind into a flat plane and don't let it move. That can be done, but if you do it, you will be no wiser when you've done it. Except for one element, you will realize that you can make yourself consciously stupid. Now, in the other practice, we have to accept the fact that this paper is not matter inert. It is power, and its essential nature is motion. So that if we don't interfere with it, it will create. It is creating. So if we still the mind, by which we mean the external five sense stimulated substance, we will become aware that this power is actually still creating. We feel its motions, but we know that they are not motions of contingent stimuli. So one of the concepts of Indian philosophy, of pralaya, the great equilibrium into which things go, is seen to be an abstract idea. If there ever was an equilibrium, there could never have been an overthrow of it. To overthrow an equilibrium, you need an external force to act upon it. There is no external force in infinity. Therefore, if there ever had been an infinite equilibrium, there could never have been any creation. There is a creation, therefore there has never been an infinite equilibrium. Factually, we have to accept this. When the contingently stimulated individual comes across a cessation of the contingent stimulus, if he is extroverted, he thinks everything has stopped because the external stimulus has stopped. And he then runs about looking for another contingent being to stimulate him. But if he knows more about his metaphysics, and instead of running away, he decides to go into a room on his own to find out what he's running towards, if he has that much self-control, and he says, I won't go to the pub tonight and jollify myself, I will sit at home and allow to arise in my consciousness all the purposes for going there. If he can make himself sit in a chair, all the impulses that wanted to go seeking that external stimulus will re-stimulate all the memories of the previous contingent situations in which he has enjoyed himself. And he will discover that he was driven by a previous external stimulus to find the equivalent again in the external world. Such kind of external determination is a slavery of the material order. If there had been an equilibrium of the 19th century pattern, where atoms had ever been stabilized in a field and there were nothing other than atoms, then nothing could ever disturb them. They couldn't disturb themselves, and therefore there could never have been a creation. One of the problems of science, so-called, is the problem of entropy. All the motions in the universe, it is seen, at the material level, if they strike against each other, being motions of bodies, there is always some energy lost in the collision, and the bodies slow down. This admits of an ultimate term of such action called maximum entropy, where they've collided with each other so often that they've now slowed down to the turn. In other words, they're quite stationary. Now, if they were ever stationary in the past, they couldn't move. And as they are supposed to be moving towards that entropy or equilibrium, in the future, when they get there, they won't be able to move either. Now, anything that has an end has a beginning. One of the problems of science, so-called, is the problem of entropy. All the motions in the universe, if you see, at a material level, if they strike against each other, being motions of bodies, there is always some energy lost in the collision and the bodies slow down. This admits of an ultimate term of such action called maximum entropy, where they've collided with each other so often that they're now slowed down to the turn. In other words, they're quite stationary. Now, if they were ever stationary in the past, they couldn't move. And as they are supposed to be moving towards that entropy or equilibrium, in the future, when they get there, they won't be able to move either. Now, anything that has an end has a beginning. So if maximum entropy is true, if there is an equilibrium towards which things tend, when it is reached, there can be no more creation after it. But if that would be an end, there must have been a beginning. And the beginning and the end would be an equilibrium. And the original beginning must be disturbed by some force from outside, because it cannot be disturbed any other way. And therefore, there must have been a time when there was equilibrium with a force external to it to disturb it, because we are in motion. If we then take this to the maximum entropy term and make the equilibrium again, creation stops. But if we've conceptually been forced to let an external force in on the first occasion, we have no reason to stop it on the second occasion. We then have a concept dualistic, an equilibrium of matter disturbed by a force non-material. This dualism resulted from naive materialism. Now, today we don't have this. We say that matter is simply the behavior of force, but that it's a unifield of force, although we would say a non-dual field, which is a higher concept, that this force is a self-moving being and has the power to wave itself, as if this paper is endowed with the power of either waving or not waving. But the difference between waving and not waving is in the meaning of the word not. If we say that a piece of string going along without knots is non-creative, but it is going along, and if it makes knots as it goes along, then it is creating. Then we see that the difference between creating and not creating is the difference of the word not. And this not also means to suffer. Not a bad English word related to the German word, spelt in the same way, not, which means suffering, passivity, and in the high sense to be deprived of one's absoluteness. If there are any knots in us, it means there are negations in us. But those negations are simply negations of the sentient power rotating round itself at that point. There is no reason whatever why we should be knotted, other than this, that wherever there's a knot, there's a reason. But it is the rotation of this sentient power, self-knotting, that is self-rationalizing. Because the rationality depends on the cycle. And it is that cycle which is a knot. So there is no rationality as a knot or negation. So if there is a reason for knot, it is simply the knot being looked at rationally. And if there is a negation at all, considered rationally, it can only be a self-tying of the absolute power. Now this self-tying goes on, literally. And the being can identify with any rotation point or not, and he can, by effort of will, initially confine himself into that knot. And he then goes round, he's in his little private eternal recurrence. He's suffering. And he is deprived of his absoluteness. If he makes it extra strong, he puts a K on front of the end, which symbolizes the application of a force against the resistance, keep it there. There is no negation, no nothing, no keeping, no slavery, no bondage, other than the bondage of self to self. That the slave is the master, self and slave. That this paper is the sentient power, that when it waves, it has the power to feel its waving more than its paperness. And it has the power to feel its paperness more than its waving. If it feels its paperness more than its waving, it is a sage. If it feels the waving more than the paper, it is an ordinary man. But that is the only difference. To feel the paperness is to be field conscious throughout. To look with your eye on the movement of the heads is to serialize consciousness and to catch oneself up and bind oneself with the form of the presentation and to forget one's own sentient power, which is not different in any way from one's own will.
Before you go, could I ask you just to give one specific example in terms of your analysis of the question? Very often a situation occurs, some behaviour pattern, from somebody outside, and I find that I'm able to grasp my reaction to this behaviour pattern and inhibit an annoyance behaviour for myself. Yeah. Then, 2 seconds later, if this behaviour continues, I find that I've fallen back, despite the fact that I previously fallen.
Yes. And the chief cause of that is that the mere fact that you are practicing the inhibition exercise means that it has not yet become fully yourself. You're still partially identified with the motion. And this is why you say you are trying to inhibit it. Now, at the moment you succeed in inhibiting it, a sub-element called self-opinion, or JT, or whatever you like, rises up, rubs his hand and says, I have just succeeded. Now that is so much energy rubbed off the inhibiting process. And you'll find, if you analyze yourself at that moment, this always occurs. Until you don't need to inhibit because you're not identified. That will happen. You will inhibit, you will succeed, if you're lucky, and having succeeded, a voice will rise in you and say, I succeeded in that exercise. But this voice takes energy off the exercise. Every voice you hear inside you is not nothing, it's energy. And it's part of your total energy.
Well, why do you get the annoyance reaction that you've just conceptually inhibited?
Well, when you inhibit, you see, you have a certain amount of, there's a stimulus there, continue. Possibility of inhibiting comes from inside here. Send out a message over here, inhibit. Now, when you start to inhibit, the energy that is spreading around here, you have to drive against it and locate it, because it's threatening to overwhelm you. Now, as soon as you close it, it starts to rotate. And it's held in by your pressure. And as soon as you've got it held in, it immediately feels to you, I can let go of it now, because it's now held in. Immediately you let go of it, because it's now held in, straight away you get a sub-ent or series of sub-ents around here who say, we have just successfully completed an exercise. And that moment, the energy that was pressing against it to inhibit it goes back into these self-conceptualizing sub-ents, and immediately this wall is pushed further into your being. And its inner formal content, namely the nature of that stimulus, now spreads and floods the sub-ents that were just enjoying themselves. And it is the original annoyance that you inhibited that is doing it, not another one. Because that annoyance is only a definite amount of motion characterized in a definite way. And the correct way is, of course, not easy to do in the first instance. First, you have to try to inhibit. But if you remember the observer is not the observed, you won't bother to inhibit. But you will dissociate and you will allow the energy of the attack to go through you, instead of trying to locate it and hammer it into quietness, which is what you do in your inhibiting exercise. You are transparent to it. The transparency of the sage means quite simply that you're not identified. There's a motion on the paper. You're the paper, but you care about the motion. A man insults you. Has he? He hasn't. He knows nothing about you. How can you insult somebody you don't know, whose characteristics you're not aware of? You fabricate an insult for me. I know a man. He lives in a certain country. I won't mention where it is. His height is somewhere between an inch and 6 feet. His colour, not worth mentioning. His hobbies and his business, we won't divulge. Insult him for me. Can you insult him without a definition? It's impossible. Now, therefore, if you are insulted, you're conceptualized. And the man who is insulting you has a concept of you. But the concept isn't you. So if you react as if it were an insult, you must be conceptualizing yourself as insultable, at least. If you know that the man is really reacting to another stimulus, that he is not deliberately trying to annoy you, but he just can't shut his mouth. He's not high enough yet to do it. So he's not insulting you because he doesn't know anything whatever about you. He's reacting to stimuli in him and opening his mouth. This is coming out. And it's no more than the motion of that paper. Supposing we draw a circle on the paper here, and another circle down here. Now this is a fact. This is you. And this is another fellow called insulter. Now a motion starting here reaches here and goes beyond. Who started the motion that went like that? I did over here. Has this one below insulted that one above? Has there really been an insult? Not at all. It's the essential nature of sentient power to produce motion throughout itself. If you're identified with that signature, a motion with the direction of it will be assumed to have been caused by the first being in line. So the little boy knows with his pea shooter. He gets in the bus queue and he looks up the queue, flirts one behind the ear of the man in front. All the man in front knows is that he's been hit from behind. So he turns around and the one behind gets shouted at. There is no such thing as individual causation. All causation is of the sentient power. The individual as such can do nothing. Of myself, I can do nothing. I can do all things through Christ, my puppy. Once that's fully grasped, you cannot be insulted. Because this thing knows nothing whatever about the formal content of this. Couldn't define it if he tried. Can't insult because he's under stimulation from the absolute. He suffers all the time. And the measure of his suffering is the measure of his identification. Break identification, there is no suffering. Suffering means to be passive to a stimulus. To be passive to a stimulus is to be at the mercy of it. And the absolute is stimulating every form all the time. That's the one to get at. That's the chief insulter. Insult means jump into. Who's jumping into all those circles I've drawn? Only the paper. The circles are on and of the paper. He has every right to himself. Might is right. It appears that INS is insulting RW, but it's not. The paper is insulting everybody. Why? In order to break identification. Why? Because they're better off without it. And then why did he make them in the first place? No, because he didn't make them in the first place. They are internal facts with superstresses on them, imposed in the contingent reaction. The paper moves, and there's a motion from here across the intervening space of the finite. It impinges on there and reflects back. Between two bodies, there is a contingent stimulus, which doesn't come immediately from the paper. There's a movement in my right hand and in my left hand to bring them together. The clash, when they hit, is not from the original will to move them. I didn't will the clash. I just willed to bring them together. The clash resulted from bringing them together. And in the bringing them together, they become more clearly aware of what they are. And this makes them progressively more and more aware of what they are not. And it is what they are not that is the trouble. So we have to unbecome the individuated level. Then we cannot be insulted, except by God, by the Absolute, that we don't mind. It's the gentlest insult we know of. We never attribute causal power to another being, and therefore we cannot be worried about it. If you saw a large lorry rolling down a hill with nobody at the wheel, with the brakes off, and you were on a narrow lane between two big banks and you couldn't get away, it rolled over you, you wouldn't feel vexed with it. You might feel vexed with the driver for not leaving the brake on. And that's because you would assume that he had responsibility. If you understand that no individual is any better than that lorry going downhill, you won't be vexed with it. And if you know that it was this paper that took the brake off, you won't be vexed with the driver either. And it is only by such meditation that you can release yourself from this error of inhibiting a reaction to a stimulus by individual effort instead of by transparency. You can see the mechanical error, can't you? That the incoming energy, as you feel it about to overwhelm you, you hammer at it. You succeed, you hammer it into a corner, and you breathe, made it. What a clever bloke. You take the energy you put against the wall and examine your clever bloke concept. Suddenly the wall expands, because the energy inside is still there. It's as simple as that.